Hi and welcome to Matrix Moments. This is Saloni, and in today's episode, we aim to uncover the learnings from serial entrepreneur Bhavin Turakhia. Bhavin is currently founder and CEO at Flock, co-founder and CEO at Zeta, and founder of Radix Registry. He started out at the age of 17 when he co-founded his first tech venture, DirectEye, with his brother Divyang Turakhia. DirectEye owned brands like Big Rock, Logic Boxes, Reseller Club, and webhosting.info. In 2014, he exited and sold all four companies to Endurance Group, a NASDAQ-listed web hosting firm, in a $160 million transaction. His neo-banking venture, Zeta, recently raised its first round of investment and was valued at $300 million. Over the last 21 years, he has built five successful businesses, all driven by his passion for problem solving and maximizing efficiency through tech-driven innovations. This episode is part two of a two-part episode and will be moderated by Tarun Davda, Managing Director at Matrix Partners India, who incidentally also happened to work with Bhavin as General Manager and Business Head at Big Rock close to a decade ago.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears to a topic which I know is very close to your heart. What role has culture played in your companies, and you know, what are some of the initiatives that you've taken to build a strong sort of, you know, company culture, especially given, you know, at various points in time you've been running sort of multiple businesses?
Absolutely. So culture is hugely important, and in fact we've done multiple exercises and evolved through the different companies I've been a part of in the early days, as well as now with Flock, Zeta, and Radix. We've evolved the values that are important to our company. So today, if I look at some of the values that we espouse in our organization, it's hiring the best, being really good at prioritization, speed and urgency, continuous learning and knowledge sharing, humility and niceness, frequent candid feedback and recognition. So there are some of these. These are some of the values that we really look for in individuals that we bring on board. We look for in leaders that we promote as managers, and in general we espouse and try and adhere to as much as possible. I've had the good fortune of being part of multiple startups, and the startup phase culture sort of becomes a bit more easier because there's fewer people and cultures percolating top down. You end up meeting everybody frequently enough, and you know, both me and sort of many of the individuals that have worked with me for now more than a decade continue to adhere to those values and in fact help me evolve them. But I think, you know, you tend to reach an inflection point when you grow to sort of 150 people, and then you grow from 150 people to like 400, 500, 1,000 people. You start reaching these inflection points where the intake of people is pretty rapid, where the you know, you yourself are not going to be able to directly interact as the founder or co-founder with every single individual in the company, and so on and so forth. And so suddenly now, what used to happen by default, what you could take for granted, which is culture percolation, you now have to put into place actual initiatives on an ongoing basis that will continue to manage culture. So some of the two or three most important aspects, and I can't really say I have solved for all of them either, but the two most important aspects, one is try and solve for culture at the gate, which means that we want to try and make sure that our hiring processes are such that we bring in individuals who are a culture fit for us. So humility and niceness, for instance, is one of our important cultural values. And invariably, everybody who's part of this organization, because of the people they are, the kind of people they attract and bring in, are also the ones who'll place others first, who are, you know, nice, have high humility and humility, etc. And so, you know, we, this notion of hiring the best, the kind of bar that we create, the notion of continuous learning and knowledge sharing. So some of these things can be tested for at the time of interviewing, and to the extent that you can at least account for 60 to 80% of your cultural values by testing them at interviewing time, you're already solving for a large chunk of culture at the gate. I was going to say the second thing that we participate in is a series of initiatives that will ensure that that we maintain this culture. So it's, you know, one-on-ones, town halls, lots of forums and avenues for people to voice stuff, and you know, encouraging people sort of in terms of pointing out culture deviations, recognizing culture sort of adherence, and promoting individuals and putting people in the managerial role If they sort of meet your cultural attributes or helping them, you know, through the process of sort of meeting those cultural attributes, they might not yet meet and things like that. So that's kind of the second big area.
Yeah. Just, I'll just make one remark. And, you know, I remember Bhavin telling you this when I had, you know, joined in 2009. You know, I had spent several years at Infosys before that, and Infosys was recognized as, you know, one of the best companies in the world as far as it came to knowledge management, right? And I remember telling you this, that I was surprised that a very young company like DirectAI at that time had invested, you know, so much in, I remember all the wikis and the Jira tools and everything that we used to use internally. And like literally every idea, every discussion, every, you know, new growth hack, every new product idea, everything was sort of, there was a wiki for it. And one, you know, that was searchable and editable, and there was a clear track record of, you know, who added it, when it was added, you know, people could comment on it. And it was just there for pretty much everyone in the company to see at any point in time. And I would highlight two things, right? One is, which honestly I thought was very, very refreshing. One was just the investment in knowledge management. And I remember all the training videos and everything that y'all had done to sort of train all the new joinees at scale, which very few young, you know, companies actually invest in. The second was this culture of transparency, openness, right? And I remember pretty much every meeting that you did was visible, and you know, notes of that meeting were visible for everyone to see in the company. And I think that unique culture where pretty much anyone is privy to any information as long as they're not misusing that, and also aligns people in terms of, hey, here is what is happening at the broader level, which I thought was actually very refreshing.
Thanks. Yeah, it's always been. I love implementing the best possible tools for knowledge management. I've also always believed that the total value of any company these days, especially even more so in knowledge era, the total value of any company is the sum total of the value of the knowledge that every individual in the company carries.
Correct.
And you can expand and increase that. It's going to increase the value of your organization.
Yeah. Okay. Coming to another topic, which I know is close to your heart, productivity and sort of, you know, tools and hacks that you use to keep yourself productive, just given how many things you're involved in. I remember reading a blog post that you had put out several years ago, which is, you know, my to-do list is my number one productivity tool, right? Or something of that sort. I remember the title was something similar. I'm sure you've learned personally a lot over time. So talk a little bit about, you know, what do you use today to keep yourself productive? What do you use to make sure that you're able to multitask and sort of, you know, keep the house in order? How do you prioritize, etc.?
Sure. So let's take each of those three things: prioritization, being productive, and multitasking.
Yeah.
I actually believe, in fact, one of the most important skill, I recently put out another post, well, a small sort of Twitter post on this, basically, that, you know, prioritization is actually one of the most important skills that hasn't been given as much sort of as much relevance by most people. But a large number of us end up doing a lot of work. I think the difference between really successful companies versus the ones that are averagely successful is that the really successful companies are consistently finding the highest impact initiatives that have the lowest requirement of investment, like low, sort of low effort, high impact, basically. And the art, if you can do that yourself as a founder, awesome. You know, you're obviously spending your time, therefore, on the most high, sort of highest value activities. If you can train an entire company of people to constantly do that, you have a compounding effect in terms of creating exponential value. And I myself have also over time kind of, I used to be a, so it's kind of interesting how there are some fundamental principles in prioritization that I've learned. So let me talk about a framework, by the way. The simplest framework is, if you have, you know, it's not about creating a to-do list is very easy. Anybody can create a task list of 50 things. And I'm quite certain every individual, every organization could create an infinite task list. I think the more important thing is not what you do. In fact, it's what you leave out actually that becomes more important, and how you are okay with leaving out stuff and how you're selecting the stuff that you should focus on. And so prioritization, you know, the simplest framework is, if you've got a list of things to do, whether it's in building a product, whether it's in marketing, whether it's choosing between functions in your organization and tasks, you want to be able to train yourself over time to be able to classify these tasks into what's the amount of effort required. Effort could be resources in terms of people, capital, your own time, etc. And what's the sort of impact that this initiative will make. And in many cases, assumed impact is, you know, one possibility, or you can validate you know, both the effort and the impact. And so my typical framework, and this we apply to whether it's product development, whether it's go-to-market strategies, et cetera, is that here are the list of strategies, initiatives we could do. And now classify each of them by saying, is the impact high, low, or medium? And don't just make assumptions. Maybe do some validations, some MVP, take those experiments, talk to people who've done this before, but figure out what the potential impact could be of this initiative. Figure out what the effort could be by talking to the people who are actually going to put in the effort. And so classify effort into low, medium, high. Classify impact into low, medium, high. And then if you're good at this discovery process, then you'll have enough number of initiatives that have high impact and low effort on a constant basis. Everything else can be discarded. Some cases will have to look at sort of high impact, high effort initiatives, but you never want to sort of touch the low impact, low effort initiatives at all. Like those or the medium ones can be effectively discarded, and you keep yourself always in the high impact quadrant, basically.
Mm.
That's kind of the framework. And this whole notion of prioritization required me personally, and this is hard for a lot of entrepreneurs to do because it's innate in us. It required me personally to shed two things, which is it required me to shed this notion of perfectionism. I used to be such a perfectionist in terms of like everything needs to be perfect. And it's a paradoxical situation because if you want to try for everything to be perfect, you'll actually end up with everything being mediocre.
Yeah. Because
you're your attention on everything, including the low impact stuff and the high impact stuff, which means you have to be okay with the low impact stuff being much less than perfect, so that the high impact stuff can be at the highest level of perfection because you have limited time. So shedding perfectionism is one of the things that I've learned along the way. Mm. And parallelly along with comes this notion of, especially when you're scaling rapidly, letting certain fires burn. You know, it's okay. You know, some things will not go well. Some, as long as they don't have a significant impact, as long as they're not going to mess your, you know, organization up or company up, et cetera, you can be okay with letting certain fires burn. Knowing that you might be able to pay attention to them at some point in time when it's right, basically. So it's counterintuitive in some sense, but prioritization, I think, is the biggest sort of effective prioritization is the biggest value creator.
Absolutely.
The second thing you spoke about is multitasking. I will actually tell you my simple formula out there, which is don't. The worst thing, the biggest hit on productivity, and I say that as somebody who was a prolific multitasker.
Correct.
The unfortunate thing is biologically, we are wired to derive a higher degree of short-term pleasure from multitasking. Because every time we switch attention and get distracted and move to a different task, we get kind of like a different
context switch. Yeah.
So wired, and these days devices and gadgets and various things make it very easy to actually multitask. You can pay 2 minutes of attention on your current task and then get distracted by a WhatsApp message and get distracted by a Flock message.
Correct.
And then get distracted by an email. I've read enough number of books to know that our brain is not wired to multitask, much like a processor, which is not wired to actually do multiple tasks at the same time. So the moment you switch your context switching, all context switching is a waste of resources. And so I try really, really hard, and I can tell you it's still an evolution for me, but I try really, really hard to focus on one thing at a time. And this dovetails very well into the previous thing that I said, which is if you have figured out how to pick the highest priority task to focus on right now, then that task should be getting 100% of your attention and nothing else. Once you give it adequate justice and get it to a certain level, that's when you say, okay, now I can switch my gear to the next high priority task and give that all my attention. So yeah, multitasking is the biggest productivity sink, and therefore not multitasking is actually the biggest productivity hack I can talk about with anybody.
Yeah. No, I think the clarity of thought in once you know what is important, and I think that's where most people struggle, is actually not prioritizing. And because they don't know what is important, they don't know where to put their resources and time. And also, they get stuck in this sort of, you know, perfection paradox, right? Which is everything needs to be perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. And then with regards to being productive, I mean, I'm constantly evolving. I try and, like, I've been using now 3 monitors since ages. Every single, I have 5 different office spaces where I work out from. Mm. And I have the same identical standing desk, chair, video conference unit, my monitors, my keyboard, my mouse. Everything is standardized after, you know, evolutionary experiments on what works best. Lighting conditions, personal tools that I use, practices that I use, document everything. One of the fundamental philosophies I follow is that anything that I repeat more than 3 times, must be sort of processified, automated, and delegated in some form. So that I'm now free to kind of, you know, one, the quality is ensured or whatever I'm repeating, and I'm free to do other things basically. So I have a huge penchant for productivity, and I try and sort of make the maximum out of every single minute that I possibly can, you know, and a lot of it, I mean, I guess it's bucketed into a few different buckets. One is try and create an environment that will maximize productivity. So it's the kind of setup that I have for work everywhere. I even if I spend like 7 to 10 days at a place, I will try and make sure that my assistants kind of set up my systems, etc., there in advance of me landing there or being there in the exact manner that I want them, so that the 10 days that I'm spending working from that new destination are going to be most effective. So I try and maximize whatever I can from like each minute of time.
Wherever you go,
knock out all mundane decisions in my life and delegate them to sort of, you know, people, etc., so that I don't have to actually focus on things that are not going to add exponential value, that are just operational tasks. That's my kind of, you know, and it's again an ongoing evolutionary process.
How do you see, you know, your personal success has shaped who you are today? So you obviously evolved, like you mentioned a few times, right? So if you look back, you know, yourself 10 years ago versus today, what is different about you?
I mean, I've learned a lot of lessons through mistakes I've made. I've made, you know, mistakes in the area, for instance, as I said, prioritization, perfection versus prioritization is an area where I've had huge evolution.
Yeah.
Notion of kind of, you know, I still have an extremely high degree of optimism, but I have spent a lot of resources, or rather wasted a lot of resources on building stuff, building, you know, investing a lot behind building something big without validation. Based on my personal assumptions. And one of the people in my team has this, you know, constant sort of saying that he keeps telling everybody that, you know, we are not the user. And he sort of threatens that I'm going to tattoo this in the inside of your eyelids so that you constantly realize that we're not the user. But I have gone through that fallacy so many, many, many times to a point where, after having learned the lessons the hard way, now I'm at the opposite extreme. I'm like, sure, we have a strong hypothesis, but what's the absolute minimum we can do to validate it to a point of like, we have a degree of confidence.
Confidence.
And we try and do that now for everything. By creating kind of internal pitch documents. We have a format for creating an internal pitch document for any initiative. And the goal of that pitch document is to essentially showcase two things. One, this initiative that you're pitching. So we call it pitch document because at the end of the day, you as a resource, like a person in the marketing team, a person in the product team, are asking the organization to dedicate your time and the other people's time behind an initiative you think will move the needle.
Correct.
So, well, first off, you've got to tell us what needle you're trying to move. Is that important to the organization? Are you focusing on, you know, revenue or profit or user base or engagement or whatever it is? There's some number that you're moving. So is that number itself important? Second, you know, what's the kind of impact you're looking at making, and prove to us that you will make that impact, like validate it through some experiments, etc. And then, you know, we compare multiple pitch documents to decide which initiative should actually bubble up to the top and get people's attention. And so sort of that whole process, it takes more time, but it ends up resulting in us doing fewer things, but the things that actually matter, than doing 20 things, but all of them result in, you know, half-baked results.
Have you become more patient as a person through this whole sort of, you know, journey of sort of self-discovery and evolution?
I can tell you patience is something I'm still working on, honestly. It is actually a personal challenge. In fact, perfectionism was a huge challenge.
And, I know.
And I've made a significant progress on it. Same for patience. I think it's still a journey. And I still have some ways to go there. But I've definitely evolved on both of those by a significant degree.
Yeah. No. What I think, just two quick takeaways for, you know, people listening in. I think, and you know, as investors, we look for this in founders when we're looking to invest, right? One is just inside out versus outside in, right? And you mentioned about, you know, this is my hypothesis, but what have I really done to validate that from, you know, people who are actually going to be using this product or service, right? And I think you know, most companies sort of fail to achieve PMF. Because a lot of what they do is basis inside out thinking, right? And very little sort of outside in validation of what they're looking to build. So number one. Number two is, I think a lot of us, you know, if I take a 2x2 matrix of, you know, what is known versus unknown, right? You can have the known knowns, you can have the, you know, known unknowns. And then there's the domain of, you know, what is unknown. And I think a lot of us end up spending a lot of our time in basically just discussing known knowns, right?
Yeah.
And very, very few people want to sort of go into the, zone of discomfort, which is, hey, but, you know, what are the things that I don't know? And, you know, are there things that I can do today to basically know a little bit more about that area or that user or that, you know, product idea or whatever it may be, right? And I think known unknowns can be, one can de-risk as a founder by listing those things down and saying, hey, what can I do to de-risk myself from these known unknowns today? Unknown unknowns are hard. Like these are like just, you know, sort of things that, you know, are most often beyond your control and very, you know, there's, you know, while one can attempt to do something about it, you know, almost always it's hard. But even the known unknowns, I think most people just try to avoid thinking about them. And I think that's one area where I've seen, so, you know, some of the best, companies that are being built by founders, very, very outside in, very, very focused on sort of solving for known unknowns and unknown unknowns also, you know, very often.
I mean, absolutely. I think some of the biggest opportunities lie in the unknown unknowns, the hardest to capitalize on, but some of the biggest opportunities lie in that zone.
Correct. Absolutely. Okay. And my final question, because I think we're going to be out of time soon. What advice would you give yourself or your younger self? Maybe if you were starting up today, and, you know, fast forward back to, you know, 15 years ago when you were starting up, what is the advice that you would give your younger self today? What are maybe, you know, top three sort of takeaways, if you were to crystallize sort of everything you've learned? And I know it's hard, but, you know, maybe top three things that you would advise yourself.
Sure. So again, I could talk about hundreds of things, but top three automatically forces me to prioritize. So that's a good, you know, lesson by itself that we're reiterating. I guess I'll talk about three messages. Again, these are all crystallized over many, many years. One is, I've always focused on, I've started calling this, or I'll use an acronym TAP, just T-A-P. Okay. The three ingredients that I think have been very important for success that I now see is talent, alignment, and prioritization. So as a company, so that's the first piece of advice I can talk about is if you can solve for these three in your organization, you've already got the ingredients for success, which is if you have the best talent, if all of them are aligned towards the one goal or metric or process or sort of, you know, objective that you want to achieve. And by the way, the most powerful tool that I've used for the second piece, alignment, is OKRs. Hmm. Yeah, very, very strictly follow kind of an OKR planning process quarterly and annually across all my companies. But it's been extremely useful if done well. Hmm. I actually have seen the videos, by the way, on my YouTube channel on OKRs that we use for all internal training.
We'll post the link in the transcript for this one.
Yes, I'll send them to you.
Yeah.
And so that's talent alignment. And third is what we already spoke about, which is prioritization. So you can all be aligned. You can have a 1,000 people team that's all aligned towards the same objectives and OKRs. But to achieve a specific KR or to achieve your objectives, what are the initiatives that you as an organization are spending your people and time and capital and resources behind? If they are the highest priority ones, then you've got a formula for success. So talent alignment prioritization, this is the first kind of, you know, piece of advice I would talk about. The second thing that I would say is focus on value, not valuation. This is something that I think is, you know, in many ways been, again, critical and instrumental for our success. The fundamental, and I see some really large unicorns and big companies that, you know, fair, they've done, you know, really well, and I have respect for these entrepreneurs, but even today are constantly focused on the next round of valuation. Some companies, I sometimes even wonder the size and scale. They're global, they have vast majority of the market share, and they're still not profitable. And to me, that just seems to feel like, okay, they're not adding meaningful, substantial value as yet. Yeah. Because if they were doing that, because I can see the scenario where you're spending money for growth at the compromise of profit, that's okay. But if you've already grown to a point where now future growth is, you know, marginal, and you're still not profitable, then there's clearly a problem in the value equation. And so to me, I think a business is something that can generate positive value for its customers and in turn be able to therefore command back revenue and profits by providing that value. And if as an entrepreneur you focus on creating value, you will automatically build a successful business. And valuation is a side effect of that. So I think that's the kind of second piece of it. Third thing that I will tell you, which I've had some failures in the past, you know, Flux prior to Pivot, and in some senses even after Pivot, it took us a while to sort of take this to heart, which is talk to customers as early and as often as you can. And I think this is an advice especially relevant for, let's say, a younger me or, you know, startup founders, in fact, even that actually in the first few years of your company is when you will have the most time to even be able to dedicate to talking to customers, and you'll be closest to them. The bigger your company grows, the more departments it has, the more people it has, you'll be so far removed from your customers, you'll never get that opportunity back. So the earlier stage you are at, use that opportunity and time that you have. Talk to as many customers as you can. Validate stuff through those conversations as often as you can. And so, those are three pieces I can think of as high priority.
I think these are excellent. Thank you so much. And, you know, I'll just add one point on the second one. Incidentally, I was talking to somebody else. He's another investor in the ecosystem. And we were talking earlier this morning about, on your point of value versus valuation, right? You're talking about how, you know, today, especially where we are today, right? It's the gap between what we're seeing in the real economy and sort of every day we're hearing about slowdown across sectors. We're hearing about, you know, potential sort of recession and all sorts of stuff, you know, global sort of slowdown, etc. But when it comes to sort of startups and ecosystem, it's never been more buoyant, right? And it's actually now getting to a point where it's scarily so. And so, you know, we were talking about how, you know, young founders, I think one of the biggest favors they can do to themselves is to actually educate themselves on how their companies would be valued if they were to go public, right? And you can keep sort of, fooling yourself about, hey, here's my last round valuation, but not knowing what kind of multiples you will actually get when you go public is, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, people just drink the Kool-Aid for way too long. And, you know, today it's very easy for people, companies that are burning, you know, even at the contribution level, let alone, you know, company level profitability, you know, a lot of these companies get 10, 20, 30 times revenue multiples. But this is all just like, you know, on paper, right? And unfortunately, you know, this doesn't last really long, right? And at some point, you know, companies need to take a down round. Worse, they figure out that, you know, the money that they raised is the last money they've gotten. And that's when, unfortunately, they need to go through the, you know, difficult sort of journey of, you know, letting go people, cutting scale, you know, finding a way to sort of somehow become profitable. And that never ends nicely, right? And so I think this point on really, really, okay, fine, you got a great valuation, you got some investor who really believes in sort of the future growth of your company. But that shouldn't let you fool yourself for a minute on what is the actual value that has been created.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, because of the fact that I bootstrapped my first company, Div Bootstrap Media.net in its entirety. I kind of self-funded Radix, Flock, etc. There's always been in some sense, the dearth of capital has actually allowed me to not get distracted by valuation rounds and instead focus on creating true value.
No, absolutely. Great, Bhavan. This has indeed been a pleasure. I think a lot of the stuff that you've spoken about is just super relevant for anyone listening in. Just in terms of A, how you go about picking your businesses, your early childhood days, sort of, you know, how you think about sort of, you know, building company culture, talk about, you know, getting validation from users very early, talk about, you know, I love the framework of TAP, by the way, which I hadn't heard earlier, but I think it's super important that one implement this very early in their company. So, you know, thank you so much. I'm sure I've enjoyed this a lot, and I'm sure, you know, people listening in are going to be, you know, take away a lot from this episode. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, Tarun. Thanks, Saloni. Thanks, everybody. It's a real pleasure talking to you guys.
Thank you for listening. And you can find the transcribed version of this podcast on matrixpartners.in. You can also follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn for more updates.